profound and infinitely subtle is rarely encountered, even in millions of ages. Now we see it, hear it, receive and maintain it. May we completely realize our true awakened nature.
Okay, so good morning. So we have this chant. It's the chant we actually did at the beginning of the meditation, the four vows of the Bodhisattva, which underscores two fundamental aspects of Buddhahood: wisdom and compassion. So as a chaplain, I understand this vow to mean that I'm committed to freeing even the least amongst us from their suffering. So I can't fix their problems. What I can do is be with them, be a presence in their life. It's a way of saying that I can't be one with everything unless I'm willing to be one with even the most wretched outcasts of our society. So this story I'm going to tell is about my own growing pains in the development of my compassion for the people at the margins of our society. So back when I was a seminary student, this would have been around 2008, 2009, we had a requirement to do an internship. It's like practice at being a chaplain. And I did my internship with an organization called Temenos Catholic Worker, which is part of the Catholic Worker movement. And it's basically a one-man operation. And that one man is a guy named Father River Sims. And his parish, so to speak, was one street in San Francisco, Polk Street, P-O-L-K. About 5 or 6 blocks of Polk Street. So Polk is a street that seems to be in perpetual transition. In the 1940s, 50s, and 60s, it was sort of the center of the LGBT culture in San Francisco. Then in the 70s, when that all shifted to the Castro, all that was left behind on Polk Street was sort of the underbelly of that culture. So it was things like a few CD bars, some adult bookstores, a few flophouse hotels, a homeless shelter, and a pretty active late night market and hard drugs and gay sex. So then in the 1990s, rising real estate prices brought some gentrification. So there's a lot of hipsters were moving into the area. And with that came some upscale restaurants and some nightclubs. And so there's this uneasy tension in Polk Street. There's on one hand, like the new Polk Street, which is kind of bright and shiny and all new. Then there's this old, dark, shadowy Polk Street, and they're kind of coexisting together. And it's kind of a tense coexistence. So into that, you've got River Sims, who's willing to minister to anybody on the street, but his specialty are young men in the sex trade. And what we would do is walk the street late at night, giving out the tools of harm reduction, which meant syringes and condoms. So one night a week, River would also provide a meal. And he did this in an alley off of Polk Street. It's kind of a dignified alley because it's paved and has curbs. And it has a name. And the name is a bit ironic: Hemlock Alley. So the San Francisco Needle Exchange people would set up at one end of the alley, and we would set up at the other end of the alley. And as the people came and went from Needle Exchange, we'd give them a meal. So one such night, we were set up and we began serving our wonderful bean soup. And we saw this guy approaching named Ricky. And Ricky was, like, obviously really high on speed. And he'd found a piece of plywood and he'd broken the plywood up into splinters. And he was using the splinters like they were daggers. And he was coming down the street, he was like coming down the alley, he was punching, like, garbage bags and cardboard boxes that were in the alley. And frankly, he was kind of scaring people. He was making a lot of noise when he was doing this. So he came over to where we were serving, and, you know, people kind of moved back. And River said to me, this could be a problem. This guy's going to scare people away. So see if you can start a conversation with him and just move him down the alley 20 or 30 yards and keep him away from here. So I did that and sat down on the curb with him, and I started my first real encounter with Ricky. So I'm just going to do a sidebar here. There used to be an existential philosopher, a guy named Martin Buber, who, if I understood him correctly, described human existence as being a series of encounters. Mm-hmm. And he put the encounters into two categories. There's the I-it encounter and the I-thou encounter. So the I-it encounter are like the mundane interactions we have every day, like the checkout clerk at the supermarket. So those encounters, it tends to be that the people are playing roles. We tend to objectify the other person. And we tend to not be dealing with the person per se, but dealing with our ideas and projections about the person. They tend to be superficial and transactional. And there's nothing like wrong with I-it relationships or I-it encounters. They're just, if you're looking for something deeper, they're less than satisfying. Then there's the I-thou encounter, which is one of mutual existence and interdependence. So it's like person meets person. And in that, there's intimacy and no judgment and the sense of timelessness. So we tend to move away from, come to those interactions and feel almost one with the person that we're encountering. So for most of us, those golden moments are pretty rare, and they only occur when we approach people with beginner's mind. But Buber, who by the way was a Jew, thought of Jesus as being the exemplar of a person who goes through life and has consistent I-thou interactions, or I-thou encounters. So coming back to Ricky, the encounter I was having with him wasn't exactly I-thou, but as an I-it conversation or an I-it encounter, it was pretty good. As we talked, I slowly was dropping my projections about him and the ideas that I had about him, and I was starting to engage an actual human being and getting to know him. Then Ricky asked me for a cigarette. And just as I was telling him I didn't smoke, three girls walked around the corner. And they were well-dressed. They were obviously on their way to clubs. And two of them were smoking. So I said to Ricky, well, here you go. Why don't you ask these girls? They probably have a cigarette that they loan you. And Ricky turned to me and said, no, you do it. To these people, I am invisible. Mm-hmm. So I'd heard that before, that people on the street complaining that to the rest of society, they're sort of invisible. So I popped up and, hey, ladies, good evening. could I bum a cigarette off you for my buddy here? And there was like no response, no eye contact, and certainly no cigarette. So before they got to me, I said it again. You know, can I bum a cigarette from you? And again, no response, no eye contact, and of course, no cigarette. Mm-hmm. So it started to sink in, like, this is what he was talking about. And I felt like I was a ghost. Or like I was in an episode of The Twilight Zone or something, living in a parallel universe. And I looked over at Ricky, and our eyes met. And then just for like, just this one fleeting moment, it's like, it was it. It was I, thou. It's like, I was one with Ricky. Then I turned back to the girls just as they were passing me by, and the next thought that came through my mind was, oh, I get it. You think I'm one of them. But I'm not. I'm actually a chaplain down here doing volunteer work. I didn't say that, but as soon as I thought it, the spell was broken. And I was right back to I, it again. That all happened when, just like a matter of moments. So, from the point of view of the girls, I kind of get it. When I was sitting on the curb with Ricky, and I hadn't shaved for a couple of days, I was wearing clothes similar to Ricky's. The main difference were my clothes were clean and his weren't. I had had a shower in the past year, and Ricky hadn't. But, you know, when I stood up, I'm sure what they saw was another homeless person and projected onto me, you know, drug addict, HIV, Hep C, severe halitosis, you know, whatever projection they may have had. And so to be fair to them, what I'm describing is like this cold refusal to encounter those at the margins of society might otherwise be described as having like good street smarts. I'm sure if their parents saw it, they would have approved of the way they handled it, just kind of moving on. And in the world of duality, where there is good and bad and safe and dangerous, street smarts are good to have. So they played it safe and kept their distance. And Ricky kept his distance as well. He made no effort to talk to these girls. So in the entire encounter, I was the only one trying to bridge the divide. And frankly, I didn't do a very good job of it. So when I stumbled into the I Thou with Ricky, I almost immediately disowned it. And I think that what was going on is that inside of me, there's a part of me that's like Ricky. And it's a part of me that I've disowned. And as soon as my psyche figured that out, it immediately disowned Ricky too, kind of pushed it away. So, it may be another way of saying, I can't be one with everyone until I'm one with myself. So if there's parts of me that I've disowned and rejected, I'm going to reject those same qualities when I see them in other people. So I think it's the case that not only does the I-Thou encounter require self-acceptance, it's something that can't be forced. It sort of happens by grace. But what you can do, or what I can do, is create the conditions that make it more likely that I'll receive the grace. So the kinds of things that I think I have to do is approach the other with beginner's mind. So I've got to drop my ideas and projections about who the other person is and just encounter them as they are. I think a second one is I have to be vulnerable. So the place where I'm vulnerable is the door through which other people can experience me. And I have to do my own inner work and have compassion for myself and acceptance of myself. That means all of myself, even the dark corners that I'd like to disown. And then doing all those things, the suspending judgment, suspending the street smarts, making oneself vulnerable, that all comes with a risk. So it's really helpful to do this in places where you've got a safe container. And like maybe the ultimate safe container is the therapist's office. You know, this doesn't all have to be in the therapist's office, but that's like an example of where you can let your guard down and hopefully your therapist doesn't use that as an opportunity to, you know, go for the jugular vein. So, and I think this Bodhisattva vow is a big deal, and I think something like it exists in most religions, maybe every religion. And I think it recognizes the fundamental truth about at least my life, which is I'm happiest when I'm in service to other people. So that's all I got.